Good morning. Welcome. The title of this session is Assessment Models of Student Learning Challenges and Implications. My name is Karen Kurtsuchi-Inkelis, and I'm a faculty member in the Curry School of Education, as well as director of the Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. And it's my pleasure both to serve as session presider as well as presenter. Excuse me. We have three very dynamic and interesting presentations, or perhaps two out of three, all relating to assessment of student learning, but from very different vantage points, as I think you'll see very soon. And in a few moments, I'm going to lead off the presentations, but first I wanted to give you a sense of how the session will go if this is your first. So we'll have three back-to-back presentations of approximately 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll open the session to questions from all of you at the end. So now I'm going to take off my presider hat and put on my presenter hat and welcome you all to the first presentation, which is Bridging the Empirical Divide of College Teaching and Student Learning. This is something that I put together along with my colleague Jesse Ryan. And again, I'm Karen Inkelis. So Jesse and I study higher education as a field. If you were listening to Lee Shulman's keynote this morning, he finished by saying that research universities would be pretty arrogant if they studied every field of study except themselves. Well, indeed, there is a field of study, this Lee very well knows, that actually studies higher education, and that is the field that Jesse and I work in. Like any field, scholarship in higher education has segmented itself. So there are researchers who focus exclusively on, say, the college experience, the student's perspective. And of course, those folks have broken themselves into community college students versus traditional undergrad students versus graduate students versus professional students versus non-traditional students, etc. There are researchers who study faculty work and life, researchers who look at organizational governance and behavior, and others who study local, state, and national policy making and how that affects higher education. Perhaps because of this segmentation, we find the literature on college teaching and pedagogy, as well as student learning outcomes, has evolved along two separate and parallel tracks or streams. On the one hand, we have literature on college teaching and pedagogy that comes from a variety of disciplinary perspectives. First, there are folks who specialize in faculty development, who become interested in not only what they're teaching, but how they are teaching it. Some of this literature takes the form of best practices or pedagogical tips, things like the NESI benchmarks for effective educational practice and McKeachy's teaching tips. There are also psychologically based typologies regarding the different ways in which students learn or process information. I'm sure you've heard of some of these. They might include things like learning through visualization versus active learning, things like that. And then there are primarily two assessment-based pockets of literature in this genre. First is course evaluations, which I'm sure many of us know well as classroom assessment. You may or may not know there is a small literature base that looks at course evaluations and their predictive abilities regarding student retention, achievement, and learning. Finally, there's classroom assessment, most popularized by Angelo and Cross. These are the types of activities, actually Lee mentioned them again this morning when he talked about the minute papers, that instructors can use in class to monitor their own students' progress. Things like the minute paper, the muddiest concept, concept maps, things like this. This is a very robust set of literature that's been developing over several decades, but the one principle and way in which it falls short is in its ability to understand student learning across, but inclusive of, disciplinary contexts. For example, the minute paper, or asking students to summarize the main point of the class's discussion at the end of that very class. It's a great process check for the instructor for that class, but it's very limited in understanding how student learning is similar or different in that class versus, say, another class in a different discipline. And I don't think anyone here is willing to defend course evaluations as a proxy for student learning. On the other hand, there is a rapidly growing stream of literature that focuses on student learning. It's largely driven by the accountability movement, external forces like accreditation agencies, state and federal governments, and other policymakers, but also by parents and students themselves. These parties are mostly driven by wanting to know what the value added of higher education is. But higher education institutions, as well as their professional associations themselves, have gotten into the act and started to develop a list of their own universal learning outcomes, the ones they think that all students should be able to possess regardless of what their field of study happened to be. I'll go into a little bit more detail about some of these in a little while. Finally, a third strand of this literature, including folks like Peggy Maki, Linda Suski, et cetera, involves the use of rubrics to assess student learning at the course or the institutional level. So why did the literature on college teaching, pedagogy, and student learning, which I think most would assume are highly intercorrelated, evolve into two separate streams? As I mentioned before, I think it's partly due to different constituencies coming at this issue from very different perspectives. For example, we have faculty who, when they teach their class, are most likely primarily focused on what it is that they are teaching and how they plan to deliver that content. I want to emphasize, I'm not saying that faculty don't care about student learning outcomes. It's just when you're putting together your course, you're thinking about how am I going to introduce Chaucer and how are we going to discuss Chaucer, not so much about, critical thinking or application of knowledge that comes at the end of the course. On the other hand, let's place this in stark contrast to those on the other side of the continuum, accreditors or public policymakers, who are truly only interested in the end product. What is it that students learned when they're in college? They're not necessarily caring where students learn those activities or those sets of skills in college, just as long as they learned it somewhere in college. And then you've got folks in the middle, like students and parents, who care both about the quality of classroom teaching and, hopefully, what it is they're learning in the classroom. Now, we can't blow off the accreditors and public policymakers much as we would like, because they are the ones, indeed, who allow us to grant degrees and set our budget allocations, particularly at public universities. But these different stakeholders' interests are continuing to contribute to the development of two separate strands of literature, college teaching, pedagogy on one hand, and student learning outcomes on the other. I apologize for the hokey symbolism here, but with the hearts and the flowers, if you knew me as a person, you'd realize this is really anathema to who I am. But it's actually a very good symbolic gesture of what I'm trying to say, which is that the two strands obviously need to come together. Amazingly, one of the best reminders I got about this very topic had to do with a student's application to the doctoral program that she was admitted to and will be working with me in the fall, in which she wrote in her application essay that the one college experience that all students share in common is that they attend class. And after studying higher education for over a decade, I forgot that, we look at all different facets of the college experience, and not just classroom, but co-curricular activities, residence hall experiences, peer interactions, faculty interactions, mentoring, etc. But she's right. The one thing they all share in common is they all go to class. So it behooves us to consider just what it is that we're doing in these classrooms in integrated ways, not parallel ways. So where do we start? Well, I think one place we might start is with the learning outcomes themselves. This one happens to be developed by an accreditor, SHEV, which stands for State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. However, I think they are outcomes that all of us profess to study in our courses, regardless of the content. Now, we may not cover all of them in our courses, but we probably all hit on one or two of them in every one of our classes. Plus, I think if we start looking at this question about what it is that what our goals are for our teaching from a learning outcomes perspective, not only will we be better at tying it is what we do in our classroom to learning, but it also will greatly help the university kill two birds with one stone, because indeed we have to show Chev that we are able to do these things in our classrooms. It's part of the core competency assessment that we're required to give to them as a result of their accreditation of us. If Chev is not going to float your boat, there are other possibilities we can look at in terms of learning outcome typologies. The two that I have listed here include AAC and U's essential learning outcomes, as well as Lumina's degree qualifications profiles. Now, I know when you look at these bullet points, you look at the words and say, well, what does that mean, intellectual skills? I only have 15 minutes, so I can't go over every single one of these. But I have printed out exactly how each of these organizations have defined each and every one of these student learning outcomes. So if we have time at the end of the session and you would like to discuss these, I'm happy to go back to them then. Once we've actually identified what it is that we hope our students will gain out of our teaching, the next question you're probably asking yourself is, sure, I know what student learning outcome I hope for my student, but how do I actually assess it? Peggy Maki argues that there are three possibilities. The first is what's called direct methods. These are some form of standardized tests, usually multiple choice, but not necessarily. In fact, Yosko is going to talk much more in depth about the CLA or the Collegiate Learning Assessment, so I'll go ahead and defer to her for that. Then there are indirect methods, which are basically surveys or interviews of students, asking them to talk about how much they have perceived they have learned over their time in a course or in college or something like that. However, I'm sure as you all know, just because a student believes that he or she is the greatest critical thinker that ever walked the planet, it doesn't necessarily mean that he or she is. So there are some issues about the validity of indirect items. The most famous and maybe most infamous survey of indirect student learning would be the NESE, or the National Study of Student Engagement, as well as another one up there, the NSLOP, which I will own completely up to. That is my survey, the National Survey of Living Learning Programs. So again, I'm very guilty of doing indirect methods myself. Finally, there are performance-based assessments. These are the kinds that look at student learning involving some sort of cumulative or integrative assignment that is typically evaluated using some sort of a performance rubric. We're going to get some more information about those as well a little later today. So let's bring the conversation back to UVA. What are the kinds of innovative teaching and pedagogical practices going on here at UVA? And what are the learning outcomes that we hope will be facilitated as a result of these innovative practices? Turns out today's academic symposium was the perfect vehicle for me to learn about what's going on across grounds. Because I served on the committee, I was actually able to read all of the proposals that were submitted to this conference. It was about 50. And so what Jesse and I did is read through all of the abstracts and tried to discern what are the innovative practices that the faculty member or the submitter is trying to showcase, and what is the learning outcome that the person was hoping to achieve. First, we have teaching methods showcased. So on this pie chart, you can see all of the different teaching methods that are mentioned in at least one of the presentations today. Some of the presentations use more than one of these teaching methods, and I'm going to let you take a look at the slide for a second. Now, although one of the criteria for the proposals was that it was supposed to include an assessment of student learning, only 63% of the proposals actually contained some sort of assessment. This sort of is a nod to my original premise, which is that it's not necessarily always the case that we tie teaching and pedagogy to student learning. However, I am quick to point out that this very presentation I'm giving now is part of the 37% because I don't have an assessment. Among those proposals with an assessment, the right pie chart shows you whether or not they use a direct, indirect, or performance-based method of assessment. A fair amount of the indirect methods use course evaluations. And finally, of those that performed an assessment of their student learning outcomes, here are the learning outcomes that they assessed, or the learning outcomes that Jesse and I thought they were trying to assess. So what am I getting at? I guess it's that today's academic symposium is a really great stimulus for the UVA community. The mere fact that our leadership has expressed this as the signature initiative that she wanted to highlight as part of her inauguration, and that there's such widespread participation in this very academic symposium from across grounds, shows to me that the conditions for studying connections between teaching and learning at UVA are very ripe. But we're all very busy people. So how can we marshal an inclusive, cross-grounds approach to studying, teaching, and learning that helps all stakeholders? And by all stakeholders, I mean including faculty, helping them understand how their teaching practices facilitate learning in the classrooms, but also external stakeholders interested in accountability issues. They need to learn if value is indeed being added at UVA, and they will ask us for that information. We have to provide it. And most importantly, to help students make the leap from what happens in the classroom to the very ways in which they think about themselves and the world around them. How do we do this in effective and efficient ways, and in a way that's not taxing our already overburdened faculty and staff at the university? Well, that very small and insignificant task is indeed the goal and objectives of the Center for the Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. That's why I was really excited to put, and I say because I was the one that helped to put this session together, because I thought this was a great springboard to have you help us talk about how we move forward as a community to go and to do this very activity. So next, we have two different ways to assess student learning, one by Josip Oroksa, looking at the collegiate learning assessment, or a direct method, and one using learning portfolios, which will be presented from the Teaching Resource Center. So Josip, go ahead.
Yes, I'm stranded to standing here. I don't like standing in a podium. But good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you for taking the time to think about these issues. What I want to talk about is the work that I've done with my colleague Richard Arum that has come out in a book called Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, that many of you may have heard about and probably not maybe good things, maybe bad things, but it's been around. This is a long-term project. Richard and I are taking responsibility for the claims made, but it has been a long-term endeavor that has relied on many people. We have had graduate students working with us. We have partnered with the Council for Aid to Education in collecting the data, and we have had the support of Ford Lumina Carnegie in Teagle in financially supporting this endeavor. So, while the two of us are undercover, this has been a long-term endeavor that benefited and needed actually lots of involvement from many different places and many different people. So, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what the study is, and in part so you can understand or evaluate or make up your mind in terms of what you think about the conclusion that we draw from that. So, here's what we did. So, in 2005, there's a sample of freshmen that were surveyed and given the CLA, and I'm going to talk about CLA in a minute, when they first entered college. So freshmen come into college in fall 2005, and they get an assessment of their critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing. And then the same freshmen are then tested again when they're sophomores, so the spring 2007, so the end of their sophomore year, and then at the end of spring 2009, the end of their senior year, right? And so you can see the extent to which the same group of students over time has made progress on this particular measure that we are interested in. We are actually following those students into the labor market right now, and I'm really excited about that because the question is, not only can we show that students have learned something in college, but I think the question is how much does it matter afterwards? And how much is it rewarded in the labor market and where and for whom? And so very excited about that part. The book and what I'm going to focus on today is based on the first 2 years of data, which is 2005, 2007, so the first year of college and second year of college, about 24 different four-year institutions with about 2,300 students. The four-year institutions really range a great deal. You have the big research university, the small private institutions, the publics, the privates, all regions of the country. If you look at them on the basic demographics and SAT scores, they relatively closely represent the higher education in the U.S., so it's an interesting group. And then there's also data 205, 209. The patterns of results look quite similar in 205, 209, and so there's not going to be another book because there's nothing new. So we do have lots of information on students, and I think that's something that's unique. We know their family background, their high schools, where they went to school, because it's important to know what they're coming in with. We have questions about a college experience in the context or college transcripts, so we can see what classes they're taking, what grades they're getting. And then we have this thing called the CLA, which, as Karen pointed out, is a direct measure of learning. So what is a CLA? Just as a brief overview, it is a direct measure of learning in higher education that aims to capture these broad skills, right? The generic college-level higher-order skills, critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing. Okay? The skills that many institutions endorse, that many of us put in our syllabi, that we often associate with a college-educated person. And this is the skills that these are the skills that college-educated individuals ought to have or at least improve upon. Why we, are interested in kind of looking at this measure is, a few reasons. One, it is a direct measure of learning. As Karen pointed out, lots of the research on learning has been done on student self-report. So students are asked, how much did your critical thinking skills improve? How much did your writing improve, et cetera? And those have challenges with them in terms of whether students know what those terms mean and whether they know actually how much they improved over time. And what do they use as a basis for that in terms of, how are they deciding that they have actually made progress. The other thing that was important to us, it's not a multiple choice test. And as educators, as a sociologist by training, I appreciated the fact that it is an essay-based assessment, which to me seems more valid way to assess these kinds of complex order, complex level skills. And then the other thing that is about it is that it doesn't try to separate out critical thinking from writing. Because arguably, if you can't write, how can you think critically? And if you, and the other way around, the extent to which these skills actually are composite, the extent to which they come together, the extent to which you actually have to do them holistically and assess them holistically. And this particular assessment that I'm going to focus on, it's a performance task, it is based on real-world scenarios. And so the idea here is being that, we should assess student skills based on potential scenarios they may face after they enter the labor market. So give them a scenario, give them a situation, give them an example of something that they may actually encounter, and how well are they going to be able to handle that kind of enterprise. And so that's, you know, it is a real-world scenario. You know, I should say that it is, in terms of Karen's point about accountability, CLA, along with CAP and MAP, are being used by the Volunteer System of Accountability. That is a consortium of institutions that agreed to voluntarily collect the information on their students and put it online and make it publicly available. And in 2016, OECD is actually going to try to, for the first time, measure these higher order skills cross-nationally. U.S. is participating. The Bush administration said no. The Obama administration said yes. So at least for the moment, we are in the study, and we're going to take a look at how well our students are doing on these general skills compared to other nations. So it's going to be interesting. But to give you a flavor of, you know, so what is this CLA? What kind of a measure is it? So here's an example. Okay, so the students come into a classroom, or they're actually now getting even more creative in terms of where they can take it, but they get a scenario. Okay, it's all on a computer. They come to a computer screen, and there is a scenario. And in essence, this is, bless you, the summary of a scenario that says, okay, it's the election year this year. You're working for Pat Stone, who's running for re-election. And one of the big issues this year's election is crime. And so Pat has argued that the way to deal with crime and to reduce the crime rate is to increase the number of police officers. Well, her opponent, okay, Jamie Eager, is challenging that and saying that is not a valid, you know, strategy for decreasing the crime rates. That's not the way you ought to approach this problem. The issue is really drugs. And that if you deal with drugs, that you're actually effectively going to deal with the crime rate because drugs are the main cause of crime. And so they get a scenario that basically describes the situation they're in. And then what they get is a bunch of materials, okay? They get some newspaper articles, they get some crime statistics, and the relationship between crime and police officers, right? They get some graphs, they get some internal memos, they get some studies, they get some evaluations of the drug rehab program that's in the area that Eager is arguing should be used instead of the police, increasing the police force, et cetera, okay? So their task is, in essence, to read through those documents, okay, analyze them, okay, think through them, sift through them, really, to understand what's relevant, what's not relevant, what's important, what supports different claims, what doesn't support different claims, to resolve any contradictions, and to then kind of synthesize that information and to decide, based on the evidence that is presented in the materials they have, does it, you know, which of these seems to kind of hold more water, right? Which of these two proposals seems to be supported by evidence that they have been presented with? Yeah. And then they have to write a memo to Pat Stone, to their employer, that says, okay, you know, based on all of this, all of these materials that I have reviewed, you know, is increasing the police force kind of a viable strategy, or is Eager's proposal actually a more viable strategy? How do you deal with that? So that's it's a very quick flavor. The tasks vary. This is more of a social science task. There are science tasks, literature tasks, arts tasks. There's all kinds of different tasks that try to cover a range of different issues. But the overall setup is the same in a sense that students get a scenario, they get a bunch of materials, and they have to kind of analyze, think through, synthesize those materials to make an argument. And then write out that argument. If you want to learn more about a CLA, as well as the rubrics in terms of how the critical thinking is defined, what does it actually mean, how do they define it, you know, how to define high critical thinking versus low critical thinking, etc. All of that is on the website. It's collegelearningassessment.org, and so you can kind of see more examples, you can see the rubrics, you can see the research on this direct assessment if you're interested. But so that's just a little background. So I should tell you kind of what we found. The book, as you can judge from the title, Academically Adrift, has a lot of disconcerting findings in it in terms of the level of academic rigor in higher education, the amount of time students dedicate to studying. So, you know, the average sophomore in our study spends about 12 hours a week studying. About a third of that is spent studying with peers, which actually ends up not being really studying. So there's only about 8 or 9 hours a week that are spent studying alone. among students in our sample, and actually NESI replicates those numbers pretty closely. So the patterns are there in terms of those findings. And then, you know, why we are kind of skeptical of the student self-reports of some of these measures, like critical thinking, is that in our study, the group of students that spend 5 or fewer hours studying alone, okay, so 5 or fewer hours studying, so very low level of time on task, very low level of engagement, their GPA is 3.2. So, you know, if they are making a judgment about how much they're learning based on their grades, right, they're doing great. Or at least they're doing quite well, right? And so, the extent to which their expectations may be misaligned with that, but also, you know, the fact that they're getting Bs is aligned with the fact that they are all expecting to get Bs. So Harris survey asks freshmen during orientation week, from the 1970s to today, it asks them, you know, how many of you expect to get a B or higher average in college? And in 1971, the first time the survey was done, you know, only 27% of students dared to say, yes, you know, I'm going to earn Bs in college. That's B or higher is going to be my average. Today, 67% say that. The time on task had actually gone down over time. Students are studying less than they did in the past, but their expectations of what they should get is getting higher, and the grade inflation has gone up, so they're getting better ideas. So there's lots of kind of those trends and patterns. But what I want to focus on here is actually a more positive story in terms of what actually makes a difference and what matters. So here's the thing. While the average trends and patterns, right, in terms of how much students study, how much they're learning, don't actually look that good and raise questions about what's going on in higher education for many students and many institutions, the important thing is to realize that there's a lot of variation. And so if you look at these scores, if 205 and 209, actually the same if you look at 205, 207, you find that, you know, about a quarter of the variation is across schools, and the rest of it, okay, so about three quarters, is within schools. Now, what does that mean? Right? So first of all, what it says is that schools matter. Okay? So where you actually go to school makes a difference, because if you go to particular schools, you actually end up improving on at least this measure of critical thinking, cognitive reasoning, and writing. But at the same time, what it says is that most of the variation is within schools, okay? That most of the kind of differences in how well students improve on this particular measure is actually within institutions. And so you can see that every institution we look at, okay, you can see there are students who are doing well, there are students who are taking the hard classes, there are students who are spending time studying, there are students who are showing gains on this kind of a measure. And at every institution, there are students who are not showing those kinds of gains and those kinds of improvements. And to the extent to which this kind of call and need, and I think Lee Schulman did it this morning, to looking at ourselves and thinking about what is going on within our institutions and where the pockets are of excellence and where are the pockets that may need improvement and how do we target those pockets. So in terms of the variation across institutions, right, we looked at one characteristic, which is selectivity, which is the one that sociologists particularly care about and I think popular public as well. So we looked at selectivity, and you do see the students who attend more selective institutions do gain slightly more. Okay? So even net of their own, you know, performance coming in, that selective institutions do slightly better, and it's in part because students at those institutions do spend a little more time studying, they spend more time on task, taking harder classes, etc. So selectivity does make a difference, but again, the 75% of the variation is actually within institutions, and so what matters within? This is from regression equations, but you can ignore that other than to think about, you know, kind of what do we find matters after we adjust for what students bring in, right? So kind of controlling for what students bring into higher education, what seems to make a difference in terms of their experiences during college. Okay, faculty expectations make a difference. That shouldn't be surprising, but I think the extent to which we pay attention to the fact that when faculty have high expectations of students, they improve on this measure over the first 2 and really over the whole 4 years. The reading and writing requirements. I mean, it's, you know, when students are asked to read and write a substantial amount, so we have a particular definitions here, that they actually show improvement. And it's interesting to know that it's when they have both reading and writing is when it really makes a difference, right? It's not enough to have reading or writing. You have to kind of think about it importantly. So when faculty have high expectations, when students read and write, this graph shows when students spend more time on task, right? So the more time students spend studying alone, progress they show on this measure of critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing. At the same time, I should point out the figure that the more time they spend studying with peers, the lower their gains on this measure of complex reasoning, critical thinking, and writing. Now, this is not to pause here. This is not to say collaborative learning endeavors should are a waste and shouldn't be used. I think the question is here: how do we actually? What does it mean to do collaborative learning as of the classroom? And how do we prepare students for those endeavors? How do we actually provide them with the skills and experiences that they can do? They can study with peers in a productive ways, as opposed to end up turning the studying with peers into socializing. Right? And so, kind of have we? Our faculty instructed, and the faculty have the skills to help the students move and make this kind of progress. And there's another difference is by college major, and that is what you may expect in some ways, that students who are in social sciences, humanities, science, and math, so the liberal arts core of the institution, those students gain more on the critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing. That's true over the first 2 years as well as over the whole 4 years of college. Students who seem to struggle the most are students in the business, education, and social work, right? So our more professional areas. So I'm just kind of to wrap up what I try to cover in a very quick amount of time is the importance of academic rigor, the extent to which what we require of our students, what we expect of them, how much time they spend on task all make a difference. This is not Einstein science. We would expect that, how much time you spend studying, what you're asked to do makes a difference, but the extent to which those standards may have been slipping over time, and the extent to which you have to really understand that the academic rigor does make a difference in terms of how much students learn during their time in college, that there is much inequality in students' experiences as well as their outcomes, at least as far as CLA is concerned, across colleges, and some of it has to do with selectivity, but also there's a notable inequality and much more inequality within institutions. The students who attend institutions, some of them are exposed to experiences that are conducive to learning, and some of them are not necessarily exposed to those. They have to do with academic rigor, but also with things like college major. And so the extent to which, I've kind of raised that call back that the variation is within institutions and the extent to which we can look at ourselves, learn about where we are excelling, learn about where we may want to focus is really a direction we would suggest for in the future. And there's a website, we have a project website if you want to learn more about what we have been up to and where the project is going. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jaspa, for putting our presentation up and also for setting the stage. And Karen, thank you very much for putting this panel together in that composition. I think it's indicative to have these various pieces together in that order because I do think the learning, the teaching, and the assessment part are all present and in a very powerful way. So Jaspa talked about a few weeks ago as part of a Teaching Resource Center session, so I do think the pieces are beginning to talk, and it's really wonderful to have this conference to strengthen that connection. Our piece, so I'm Dorothy Bach, I work at the Teaching Resource Center, I teach in the German department, my colleague Mauro Bonnet, the director of the center, and a professor in French is also here, and we brought two students, Hannah Tribble, who was my student in 2006, I believe, in a class, and Bonnie Stender, who was Marva's student last year. So Marva and I want to talk not so much about the findings of a study we did, but more about the process by which we collect data, because I do think the process is highly adaptable to many disciplines, even though we come from humanities, and we would simply like to share the process and then also talk about the process itself as a pedagogical intervention. So the process is about collecting information about what students are learning, but in itself, this process too is a pedagogical intervention in the sense that it fosters students taking responsibility for their own learning, and also reflection on what they learned. The research shows strengthens the memory of what is learned, and also motivational aspects come into the learning portfolio as well. So it's really nice to follow a presentation on the importance of the connection between teaching and learning, and also on Jasper's findings that there is a strong connection between a lot of reading and writing and the fostering of critical thinking and writing skills. And we do believe that the portfolio is a way to set your class up in a way that students do exactly that, read and write a lot during the course of the semester. We do this in a particular way. Moira will talk more about it. I also want to point to the handouts on your tables that give you a lot of information about how this process can be set up in a way that it actually is meaningful. Any process needs attention. And so, and I wrote a little article that's also on your table about the use of portfolios in the humanity classroom that might be helpful for you if you are thinking of doing learning portfolios in your classes. So you also have the assignment actually of the my assignment on the second page. Marva's assignment is on the blue page, and we also have some samples of what students write in those portfolios. And what is a learning portfolio? And here's a quote that you can read. So portfolios come in any shape or form. You can do them electronically, you can do them on paper, you can do them for a whole curriculum, but you can also do them for a single course. And we will talk about a course portfolio in our session. So course portfolios are created in response to an assignment that comes at the end of the course. I do it in lieu of a final exam, but I actually give it the assignment to students at the beginning of the class because it sets the tone for the way that students are supposed to do their work during the course, namely write continuously, because at the end they will be asked to select passages of their writing to be put in the document portion of the portfolio and then write a reflective essay on what they have learned and what this learning means to them. So there's a motivational aspect that, you know, again, students take ownership of their learning. So the questions the portfolio asks: what have you learned in this course? Why does it matter? How do you plan to use what you have learned in the future? So these are essential questions I think we all are interested in, and also point to ways that we can assess the learning. So why do we do it? Research on learning shows that people connect new information to old things, new experiences to old experience, and we believe that we as faculty members can be more effective teachers when we give students opportunities to tap into their pre-existing knowledge and experience and to reflect on how the new relates and interacts with the old. So, you know, sometimes students build this is how learning works. We all build new information on top of old information, and this can sometimes lead to very shallow learning if the old model isn't really replaced by a new conceptual understanding of a problem. So giving students a tool in the hand that they reflect and see how their own learning progresses is what the portfolio does. So research on learning also shows that student motivation is central to learning. And we believe that faculty can actively foster students' interest in the material by giving them opportunities to discover and reflect on what's meaningful to them personally. We also believe that faculty can encourage students to take ownership of the learning process, and again, this is a way we can do it. When we asked faculty in our workshops what are their goals for student learning, a lot of things that Jasper pointed to come up, critical thinking, writing skills. Dee Fink puts it in a taxonomy. So foundational knowledge is something what we want students to learn. We also want them to be able to apply what they learn. We want them to be able to integrate different realms of knowledge. And we also want to teach them during the course of their college career to interact with other human beings, to be open to interact with human difference. We also want them to care about what we teach. Again, chances are that they continue to learn in that field if we really attend to motivation. And we also want them to become lifelong learners. The problem is that the way we traditionally design our courses is very much on the right-hand side of this goal spectrum. We attend to the knowledge, the application, maybe the integration, but we not explicitly address the left hand of this pie chart. And again, I do think there are ways that a portfolio can help do that. And I will turn, and actually you have flyers on your table. If you really want to think thoroughly about a course you want to redesign or a new design, we have a course design institute coming up at the end of May in which you can rethink how you do, rethink your course in light of student learning with a group of about 35 faculty members. The deadline for applying to the course institute is tomorrow. Okay, I will hand the mic over to Marva, and then we hear our students.
Thanks, Dorothy. As you can imagine, all of us at the Teaching Resource Center are very engaged with the idea of reflection and appreciate the value of reflection to our students. The learning portfolio is, of course, strongly represented in the courses that we teach. Here are the courses from which you have examples in your handouts. Michael Palmer's University Seminar on Infinity, my French course about Victor Hugo, and Dorothy's Comparative Literature course, as you can see the title. Our courses contain and share certain characteristics that may or may not apply to the courses that you teach, but we want to give you a sense of what these courses are like. Our students come from a variety of majors, probably in great measure because our courses are highly interdisciplinary. The courses, as Dorothy said, contain a significant amount of writing and a wide variety of types of writing. Students also have a chance to pursue their own interests in many ways. They have a choice of activities during the course of the course. Often their questions direct our discussions. In my course, and I think in others of these courses, they choose their own research topics. Our courses have been discussion-based seminars with up to 30 students, and it's certain that many of you teach larger courses and different kinds of courses, but we believe that the learning portfolio can work in any kind of course. Michael uses sorts of learning portfolio activities in his 100-person chemistry lab course as well. As Dorothy said, the learning portfolio is inherently a reflective task in itself, and we build in many reflective tasks through the semester. The portfolio, any reflective task, needs to be a thoughtful one. As Lee Shulman said to us yesterday morning when he came over to visit and talk with us, reflection needs to be very thoughtful and ask the students to step back and think metacognitively about what and how they're learning. So when we integrate reflection into the fabric of our courses in various ways, students develop a habit of deep thinking about the material. They also develop a habit of thinking about how they're developing their skills and what they are learning from the course. So the learning portfolio, as part and parcel of these reflective tasks, becomes embedded in the course, and that's essential. So you have here a list of some of the kinds of reflective activities that we do. And in the handouts, just let me point you to page 4, fourth page, which is this salmon-colored one. This is an example of a paired set of reflective tasks that I do in my course. Ask the students to articulate what they're bringing to the course and what they expect to gain from the course, both right before they start the course and about mid-semester, two-thirds of the way through, so that they can think about that. And then I give those ideas back to them at the end of the semester, ask them to articulate to what extent they've achieved their own goals and also the goals of the course. And on the next page, page 5, in Cassandra Fraser's article from our newsletter, you'll see a detailed explanation of students' reflection on their goals laid out kind of blow by blow for you. And we're really, truly delighted that Hannah Tribble and Bonnie Stender have come. Bonnie, as Dorothy said, is a student who took last year my course. Come on up. Bonnie took my course last year as a second-year student, and Hannah took Dorothy's course as a second-year student. And they're going to talk for a couple of minutes about what they learned from the learning portfolio experience. Thanks, Bonnie.
Good morning. Thank you and Professor Barnett for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to start simply by emphasizing what an interesting and enriching experience I had as a student participating in Professor Barnett's Victor Hugo course and making use of the learning portfolio. Our learning portfolio gave a sense of organization and direction to the course above and beyond the usual guidance that the syllabi of most university courses provide. This direction was very helpful to me and my other busy classmates as we attempted to navigate our workloads both within and outside of this course. Also, having a choice of research topics increased my motivation for writing essays, since I had greater leeway to pursue subjects that were personally more interesting and exciting within the parameters of the course's subject matter. And the enthusiasm that resulted from this freedom was well worth the intellectual challenge of devising our own essay topics. Finally, using the learning portfolio allowed me to connect learning within the classroom to real life emotions and experiences. For example, in writing my final paper on the role of children in Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, the learning portfolio helped me to reflect on the differences and similarities between Gavroche and my little brother Luke. And I sympathized with and I think took a greater interest in Gavroche's character due to my sincere hope that Luke would never be in the same poverty-stricken and parentless situation as Gavroche. In conclusion, in my experience, the learning portfolio had several significant academic and personal benefits and contributed to a more rewarding class experience overall. Thank you.
As Marva mentioned, I graduated in 2009, and after hearing about Academically Adrift, I'm a little nervous to testify to you what I think my undergraduate experience meant, but I'm going to, because I've been thinking a lot about it in the year and a half since I graduated. And what I've come to is that the most valuable thing I learned over the course of college was to respect my own perspective, my own voice, and my own way of seeing things, because now it's all I have. I'm out of school, just on my own, figuring out what I want to do. And so the value of a liberal arts undergraduate education has been giving me that voice. And I remember clearly when it started to happen, when I took Dorothy's class second year. I remember being asked to reflect on what was important to me in what we were talking about, to write about, you know, a paragraph even, or a short essay about what I valued in what we were reading. And for the first time in college, I was thinking about what I really thought. So that was absolutely important and critical to my education. The other thing I remember from this experience was learning to respect the interdisciplinary nature of different majors in different departments throughout the college. So I was an anthropology and English major. And for the first time again, I took up that identity in Dorothy's class and spoke as the anthropology major and offered what particular perspective that lens could lend to what we were talking about. So I came to develop the idea and the understanding through my anthropology that all the different departments and all the different majors are just different ways of approaching truth and knowledge in the college, and different kinds of people approach it different ways. And so in Dorothy's class and throughout college, I came to respect what my lens was and what my voice was. And I absolutely attribute that to the way we learned in her class. So I think it works.
I want to thank both Hannah and Bonnie very much for speaking, and also point out that I think their stories show how important the personal connections are, and also to note that research shows that helping students, giving students a chance to think about what's important to them, helps promote an inclusive learning environment. And I'll let Dorothy wrap up.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Barney. So what's the assessment piece in the learning portfolio? You can, you know, obviously students are asked continuously to think about the work they do in the course and to make meaning of it. But you as an instructor might be wondering, so, you know, how, you know, what's the data points that I'm gaining through the portfolio process? So assuming that you have established methods of evaluating the writing that students produce throughout the semester, you probably will already have assessed the individual pieces that go in the document portion of the portfolio. What you have in the document portion is things that students select and their guidelines for, we ask them to select certain pieces and then comment in the reflective piece on what these pieces mean and how they show progress on certain dimensions. It can be the writing itself, it can be the knowledge about the content that they are learning, and also, you know, again, ask them to make connections between different fields of knowledge. What you also have is you have the view of the progress of the student in one place. You can see how they wrote at the beginning of the semester and at the end of the semester, students comment on it. The reflective essay, so that the task of pulling the portfolio together, selecting these pieces and then reflecting what they mean. In my class, it's a 5 to 7 page essay. Gives you another data piece in assessing the effectiveness of your course. It is a window into the diversity of ways in which students make meaning of what they learn. It helps you understand what pieces resonated with your students and which didn't. And you can make adjustments if, you know, something doesn't come up at all, you probably want to drop what you did. Also, if students have only a foggy idea about what they really learned in your class, chances are that they didn't learn much. If they can't tell you how the material in your course connects to other fields of knowledge, chances are that they will forget it quickly. If the connections are not made, forgetting happens easily. If they can't tell you how they plan to use what they have learned after your course is over, you may need to think about ways to make the material more relevant. So these are all ways in which it can work in multiple others. The tricky part of the portfolio, and faculty always ask this, how do you assess the reflective statement, this indirect comment on your course itself as a piece of student work? And actually it helps too, so I think it can be done. You can, you know, again, assign a percentage to that reflective piece. You have a rubric in your handout. It's on the third page, I think. This is the way I tell my students I will evaluate their reflective essay. I tell them also that this is not the place for flattery. Please don't tell me how wonderful the course was. I really want to know what you learned in it. Course evaluation are for that part. You can flatter me as much as you want to, but this is really about you. So there are various ways that you can guide students to sincerely reflect, and also how to guide the depth of the reflection by giving them some guidelines on how to do this. So if you want to do a portfolio in your course, you have to ask yourself different questions, and they are here. You also have a handout. This is the lavender sheet, the first page of the lavender sheet, that gives you a list of questions to ask yourself that would be helpful. And you're on the very last page, you have the bibliography of things you can look into if you would like to do a portfolio or come to the course design workshop in May and think about these things. So this was it. I hope you found it inspiring. We will be happy to ask questions. And if you have specific questions about the learning portfolio that you can't ask, please email Marvo or me. Thank you very much.